This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Alexander, and here's what's coming up.
10 to 15% of global trade moves through the Red Sea. So keeping that trade flowing without interruption or harassment is important for all of our countries.
That was U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin on the creation of a multinational security force that will patrol the Red Sea and protect vessels that have increasingly been coming under attack by Houthi rebels. Details to come. Also, the DRC is holding its national elections today, and the African Development Bank says it's withdrawing its international employees from Ethiopia. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, voters have waited in line for hours to vote in the general elections. Our Swahili service colleague, Abu Shakur Abud, is in the DRC capital, Kinshasa, and earlier today, he spoke with editor Kate Palin Dawson about what's been happening today. They started by talking about the scene there in Kinshasa.
It's calm. The whole city is calm. The whole city is on vacation. Today was an official holiday, but it's a chaotic scene at all polling stations. The polling stations have been chaotic. They have been open late, 2 to 3 hours late. I was also just informed that there was some stations were not open until 1 p.m. So that's really, really late. And that's what is happening in the city. The mood, of course, people are just confused. Why was it delayed? Why the Electoral Commission CENI was not prepared to be at this time? And if in Kinshasa the situation is like that, how about the rest of the country?
So you had talked about the problems in Kinshasa. What does that mean for voting in villages and Eastern DRC, where there's always a concern about security?
Well, the situation which is happening in Kinshasa is repeating itself in the whole country. Our stringer in Goma is reporting that at one refugee camp near the town, where there was voting stations, refugees came and stole the material because they are not able to vote. So they said, we are taking this and going there. So there's an investigation going down there. In Equator, some people burnt electoral machines because they believed somebody from the government, a member of parliament, passed through the office before anybody else, and he was not supposed. So you have incidents which are small but can be significant in the outcome of the results. In many regions where there's no electricity, the machines have independent batteries, but they've discovered some of the batteries are not working properly. So you have a lot of issues taking place, and we don't know how the outcome is going to be.
Now, when do we expect the results?
The machine, which is so modern, we are told they can get results immediately. But now we are questioning ourselves, view the way they are working, view the way they have ill-prepared this thing. Will they be able to get all the results and be credible? But according to the Constitution, the Electoral Commission has until the end of the month to produce the results. So they have time, but we are expecting results to be known by the end of, I don't know if I can say today, because I don't know if the time will be extended, because we believe, most of observers and reporters, this cannot finish today. So we don't know what's going to happen. So we can't give you a deadline. When do we expect the results?
One quick question. You just said it might not end today. Is there a plan to possibly extend voting then?
Now, there comes a constitutional issue. There is no constitutional issue saying that the elections can go on the second day. I talked with an senior advisor of Tshisekedi who was voting in one of the stations, and he said he's hoping that the CENI will extend until 7-8 until all the people vote. But the issue is here by 6 o'clock, it's dark. Many places we have seen in the voting is taking place in primary schools, which have no electricity. So they can't go on to the night. So there is all those infrastructure issue, which can be a challenge.
That was editor Abdu Shakur Aboud with VOA's Swahili service. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson, from Kinshasa. Meanwhile, Congolese voters around the world are gathering at their country's embassies today to vote. Reporter Jeannie Niwa with VOA's French to Africa service is at the DRC embassy here in Washington. We have her on the line now to tell us what's happening there. Welcome, Jeannie.
Hi there. So yes, this is a historical moment for the diaspora in the United States. The voting is happening in the basement of the embassy. I would say the room is divided in two sections. You have a waiting area because it is cold today, so you have the voters who are able to sit down. The other section is the voting section. Electors are welcomed by the commission. They go from one station to another. The first station is where they show their card. Passing that station, they will pass in front of the observer, then go to the president who will explain to them how to vote on the bulletin. The diaspora can only vote for the presidential, and, you know, that is it. So it's one bulletin. It's explained by the president, then they go to the machine. The machine, they will see the different picture of the candidate. From that point on, they will confirm the vote. The picture will be shown in the back of the bulletin. From that point, they will go to another station where there will be their card will be returned. They will sign the presence, and then their finger will be inked. And from the machine, they will go in the middle of the room, put the bulletin in the box, see-through box, and then get their card returned. It's happening slowly but surely. There's approximately 20 people, and the people are still coming.
So what's so significant about this vote?
Well, you know, the diaspora always felt, I think, disconnected, and this is a moment where, you know, the voice will be heard.
So what are people saying about their experience there voting? Are they confident about this election process?
They are confident. They are still observing. I didn't get a chance to talk to a lot of people. They're very focused right now, but they are talking in front of the voting. They are sharing their experience, and they seem to enjoy it.
Thank you, Jeannie, for joining us.
Thank you.
Liberia's president-elect says he plans to declare his assets as part of the effort to weed out corruption. Joseph Boakai says he also plans to institute a measure to ensure transparency and accountability in his administration's fight to eliminate financial malfeasance and wrongdoing. This, he says, he plans to do by working with international partners to audit the government and the outgoing administration. His remarks came in an interview at the VOA studios in Washington with VOA's Peter Claudi yesterday. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
We start by making sure those people that we bring to cabinet are people of integrity. And secondly, want to make sure that even beginning with myself, we'll declare our assets and want to make sure that this is well known, the purpose of coming to government to know that it's public service. And if you are not ready to serve the public, you can go elsewhere. But we want to make sure that we start on a clear note that the people of our country stood on line, they protected the votes, not to bring a team again that will do the same thing that the other people are doing or worse. So it's a clear message, declare your asset, make sure that we are prepared to audit the outgoing government so that they tell the Liberian people of their stewardship, and to make sure that we start on a footing where people know that they come to serve the public and not themselves. If they don't understand that, they actually fall where it may.
Mr. President-elect, you talked about asset declaration starting from yourself and the people who work with you, as well as the outgoing administration. How do you plan to avoid the semblance of targeting people? Because some people will say these are politically motivated to tarnish their reputation or to go against them, people from certain tribes or specific parts of the country. How do you plan to avoid this?
We are aware of that. And when we talk about auditing, it's not going to be a Liberian auditing. We want to make sure that our international partners work with us for a public tender, for competent and renowned auditing firm that will be qualified at an international level to make sure they come on board to do that. We are aware of people saying wish hunting. But I don't think it's wish hunting when you have to account for your stewardship, but it has to be done in a way that is well-established entity with reputation to make sure that it audits and make sure that it reports to the public the findings.
That was Liberia's president-elect, Joseph Boakai. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Clotty here in our Washington studios. The Electoral Commission of Liberia declared Boakai winner of last month's presidential runoff, defeating incumbent President George Weah. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The United States has announced the creation of a multinational security force that will patrol the Red Sea and protect vessels that have been increasingly under attack by Houthi rebels. VOA's Veronica Valderas Iglesias explains the initiative's importance and how it relates to Israel's military offensive against Hamas in Gaza.
In response to increasing attacks on commercial vessels by Houthi rebels in Yemen, more than a dozen countries, including the United States, will now jointly patrol and share intelligence in the southern Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin explained the need for the so-called Operation Prosperity Guardian during a visit to Bahrain on Tuesday.
10 to 15% of global trade moves through the Red Sea. So keeping that trade flowing without interruption or harassment is important for all of our countries. And it's vital to maintaining the rules-based international order.
The Iranian-backed Houthi rebels say their actions are in retaliation for Israel's military operations in Gaza. But worldwide condemnation of the rebels' actions is only growing louder, said National Security Council spokesman John Kirby during a briefing at the White House.
Secretary Austin also convened in the region a meeting with ministers, chiefs of defense, senior representatives from 43 countries, as well as the European Union and NATO, to discuss what we're doing in response to this increased threat.
In Gaza Tuesday, there was no respite from the Israeli military offensive against Hamas militants, who on October 7th launched an attack on Israel, killing at least 1,200 people and taking more than 200 hostage. But Israeli President Isaac Herzog did leave the door open for a negotiated truce with their leadership.
Israel is ready for another humanitarian pause and additional humanitarian aid in order to enable the release of hostages. And the responsibility lies fully with Sinwar and the leadership of Hamas.
Hamas' senior official, Bassem Naim, made the group's stance clear.
We affirm our position of categorically rejecting to hold any form of negotiations over prisoners exchange under the continuing Israeli genocidal war. We are, however, open to any initiatives that contributes to to ending the aggression on our people and opening the crossing to bring in aid and provide the relief to our Palestinian people.
He noted that the Ministry of Health in Gaza estimates the death toll of Palestinians has reached almost 19,500, with more than 52,000 civilians injured. VOA cannot independently verify those figures. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
After securing another term in office in elections this month, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said Egyptians lined up to vote not just to choose their president for the next term, but to express their rejection of this inhumane war in Gaza to the entire world. He described the war between Israel and Hamas as Egypt's primary challenge. Ambassador Ayman Zain al-Din, former director of media at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, recommended that Egypt build an international alliance to support Palestinian rights and formulate the basis for a final settlement of the conflict. He explained that to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi.
I've been working with the Egyptian government for almost 40 years, and I'm quite familiar with the diplomatic powers that Egypt possesses, and I think Egypt is able to do that. In particular, I believe Egypt would be able to do that because this is not an Egyptian endeavor, even if the idea I offered in my article would be an Egyptian idea. The desire to work together to solve the Palestinian question and provide the Palestinians with the rights they deserve is a globally held desire. Many, many countries in the world want to see that happen. If you look at it from the West, there is this desire to see that the Palestinians get the right to self-determination. So this, it's actually an idea whose time more powerful than an idea that whose time has come. And I think this idea has broad support globally. So in terms of ability, I think Egypt is able. I think Egypt is already taking the lead in many activities in the United Nations and elsewhere to advance this matter. But I believe and I hope Egypt does more. Egypt can and should be doing more because a lot of work has to be done and Egypt is demanded to take a leading role in it.
You recommended that Egypt should exert an effort to create a new formula for the Palestinian national movement that would be able to rule Gaza after the war. Can you explain how and why?
Egypt should be there to support the Palestinians in rebuilding the structure for the Palestinian national movement as a whole. And this new structure should be in a better position to rule Gaza, but not just to rule Gaza, for the whole Palestinian national movement. I think this has been in discussion for some time, even before the October 7 war. The negotiations to reunite the Palestinian factions because of duplicity and confusion. So what I thought is something that needs to be done to continue on those efforts, but in a more fundamental way. Why I said that? Because I believe that the PLO was developed with the backing of Egypt in the 60s at the time of the big confrontation between the Arab world and Israel. The Palestinian Authority was built with Egypt's backing in the 90s, at the time of the Madrid Conference, the Oslo Accords, the peace process that envisioned within 5 years the building of a Palestinian state. I think the two structures, the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, were built in a different world than within which we live now. It's a different world altogether. The Palestinian society changed. We have new factions of the Palestinian national movement that are outside both structures, and the whole Palestinian national cause could be on the verge of taking different shapes and different momentum. This is why I suggested the idea, a new structure that will be able to represent Palestinian role in the world, how to bring together all factions of the Palestinian political movements, all factors, all elements of the Palestinian society, including the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and to define what is their objective, a two-state solution, maybe to become citizens of a single state, an idea that many people are talking about right now, or any other alternative. But it has to be a new, fresh structure, more relevant to the time. But it has to be a Palestinian exercise. The Palestinians are a resourceful people, very intelligent, very well educated, in the best position to know exactly what they need. But I think this is an idea whose time has come as well, and the Palestinians need to restructure the national movement.
So is Egypt on the move to play its role after the war, or just on a waiting mode?
Of course, Egypt's mind is set on what's going to be happening after war. But the problem is that Israel is insisting on continuing the war for a long time in such a destructive and inhumane way. But I think Egypt should. And I won't be surprised if it is to some extent already working to develop its ideas on how to handle the future. Problem is, none of the parties in those discussions is now ready for those discussions, neither the Palestinian Authority nor Hamas nor the government of Israel. None of them is in a position to be engaged. I'm not sure if it is now putting as much effort as is necessary in it, if only because of the burning situation in the Gaza Strip.
That was Ambassador Ayman Zain al-Din, former director of media at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. Researchers in Australia have developed a method to make hydrogen from seawater without a costly desalinization process. This could mark a breakthrough in the production of clean hydrogen from plentiful, eco-friendly source. VOA's Julie Tabot has more.
Hydrogen is an important and abundant element that's increasingly being used to power our cars and generate electricity to heat our homes and businesses. But most of the world's hydrogen is derived from fossil fuels, which creates millions of tons of polluting carbon dioxide each year. Green hydrogen, however, can be produced by renewable energy, such as wind or solar power, without carbon emissions. And now, researchers at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Australia have developed a way to make green hydrogen directly from seawater without putting it through desalination, which is a costly and carbon-polluting process. Nasser Mahmoud is Vice Chancellor, Senior Research Fellow at the university. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
The reserves that we have for fresh water, they are very limited. And to produce 1 kilo of hydrogen, we need 10 kgs of water.
With the world grappling with a growing freshwater crisis exacerbated by climate change, hydrogen production at that scale is simply not sustainable.
So we need to find alternative ways. We searched for over 7 years and we found that seawater is the best option.
Once the team collects the seawater, they use an electrolyzer to split the water directly into oxygen and hydrogen.
There's no other possibility at the moment that we can decarbonize our society. That's why we think that our technology is a big, big threat.
Clean hydrogen is central to the Biden administration's efforts toward a cleaner energy future as more countries explore it as an alternative fuel source. Sunita Satyapal is director of the Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Technologies Office at the U.S. Department of Energy. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
Countries are recognizing that in order to meet their climate goals, they're going to need a carbon-free molecule. Hydrogen really offers that versatility for multiple applications.
Mahmoud and his team are among a growing number of scientists working on innovative hydrogen initiatives as a sustainable fuel source for the world. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays.